The Future of Teamwork is a Leader production. Subscribe today and never miss an episode.
Imagine a place where you go to work every day. You make a contribution to something bigger than yourself. You learn something new. You're protected and you're set free by a compelling set of values, and you go home happy. Here's the magic. Happy people build happy families. Happy families build happy communities, and happy communities build a happy world. And nobody will argue with you and I today that a little happier world would not be a bad thing.
Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast. My name is Dane Gruneveld, and today we're celebrating our 200th episode, and it's great to have Gary Ridge back on the show. Gary came on very early days when we were just starting out, which I really appreciated, and has always been an inspiration to me. He's the chairman emeritus of WD-40, the founder of The Learning Moment, and author of Any Dumbass Can Do It. And one of the great pleasures that we've had over the last couple of years is a chance to bounce some ideas around and even get together in person at the Healthy Team Summit last year. So Gary, thanks for your friendship, partnership, and great to have you back on the show.
Yeah, g'day, Dane. And I'm an Aussie too, just like you, right?
Yeah. That's a key point. It was one of the central criteria in selecting the 200th episode guest.
Well, we won't tell people I was singing Waltzing Matilda in the test zone.
That's right.
I'm not a very good singer, but still know the words.
It's funny. Some of those words and songs never leave you. My parents' farm back home, their neighbor down the way is John Williamson. So he's often got his tunes going out the back, and you just sit up on the top lawn and watch, and it's amazing.
What a great Aussie. Love a lot of his work.
Yeah, it's magic. Yeah. So since we last spoke, a lot's been changing for leadership teams. You and I pre-show were talking about uncertainty becoming a norm and not a disruptor anymore, and just what that means for teams that need to sit with it. So maybe we should jump right in there. Like, what are you seeing last 6-12 months that's really pressing leadership teams and creating both challenge and opportunity?
Yeah, as we talked about, Dane, I think uncertainty has become a norm. And I said to you, maybe isn't indecision, it's intelligent patience these days to be able to pause. But, you know, there are a lot of things converging all at once that are so different, I think. You know, we've got, you know, AI, the impact of AI, you know, the global unrest, uncertainty in the economy. You know, there's so many things that when, you know, I was in full time leading the company, you know, we'd get these events that sort of happened. And I used to say, is this an event or a trend? And normally it was an event, not a trend. And I think uncertainty now is a consistent event. So I think a lot of leaders are thinking about uncertainty in a different way. And it's here. I mean, we have to learn that is, dealing with it is now table stakes. Forget about anything else.
Yeah. I was talking to a friend, Lindsay Kaplan, the other day, Gary, and on that point, she said a lot of leaders are feeling lonely, they're feeling isolated, and they're feeling exhausted. And sadly, when they feel that and the pressure's on, they push really hard on their teams. Hey, we've got to catch up on AI, or hey, we've got to have a new strategy for this new thing. And all of a sudden, as they push on their teams become lonely, isolated, exhausted. Is that an example of
absolutely
what you've seen?
Yeah, and you know, and again, that's why, you know, I often talk about one of the key foundations of great organizations is, do I know and feel like I belong? Mm. And it's a shame that these leaders feel isolated, exhausted, and where they are. And a lot of times they're in that situation because they've created it themselves. Instead of creating an environment that's engaging, you know, I had a post on LinkedIn the other day where I talked about the way I used to introduce myself at WD-40, which was, g'day, I'm Gary Ridge. I'm the consciously incompetent, probably wrong and roughly right chairman and CEO of WD-40 company, and I need all the help I can get. And that post got over 600,000 hits. And I, you know, I was talking to the guy who helps me with social media, and I said, why, what, you know, that thing blew up.
Yeah.
And he said, I think it's because, you know, vulnerability is, and sincerity around vulnerability is so powerful. And truly, that statement was a statement I made because I wanted people to understand I couldn't do it alone.
Yes.
And I need your help. I mean, you're right. Being the CEO or leader of a company is a very, very lonely place. And you can either make it more lonely or make it less lonely, depending on who you are.
Yeah. It's a great tie-in to mattering. And you mentioned belonging. I'm doing a lot of research on mattering right now, Gary. And I know, listening to a few of your different podcasts, including the one with Sinek, it's interesting looking at that combination, like when you matter to somebody to that point, like, do I feel like belong, but then am I helping? Is the workplace different because I'm here? I think a lot of people are yearning for that too.
Yeah, well, you know, I have these four foundations: belonging. Do I know and feel like, and am I treated like I belong? Mattering to me is, do I know the work I do makes a difference, and matters, and am I being recognized for it? Number three is, am I in an environment where learning becomes the objective, not failure and fault? And finally, and one of my equally favorites is, am I being coached, not managed?
Mm.
And I, you know, I dislike the word hate, but I hate the word manager, particularly in organizations. We're not here to manage people, Dane. And it's interesting when you change that word and you describe to leaders that their job is to coach, the whole environment changes. You know, I'd say be under no misunderstanding. The only reason we exist as leaders is to help those we have the privilege to lead be able to play their next best game.
Yes.
And when you think about everything, you know, we just had the privilege of enjoying a great season of soccer with the World Cup, right? Do you think the coaches weren't there to help the players play a better game? Of course they were. They weren't there to manage the coach, the team. They have a team manager to make sure that they have a hotel room and, you know, all that stuff happens. That's the mechanics, but the real game is on the field.
Yeah.
So our job is to be a coach, and it makes such a difference. And as you know, we changed the word manager to coach when I was at WD-40 because our job was to help people step into the best version of their personal self. And that puts an amazing amount of responsibility on the leader to be that person that they need to be.
I want to pause on that one, Gary, because I've heard you say it before. I think now more than ever, it's landing as necessary, not just helpful. And when you talk about the huge amount of responsibility that lands on that person who's shifting into coach from manager, what comes with that responsibility? Does it also bring, you know, other factors? Is there perhaps relief that comes with that responsibility and the shift in mindset?
I think there becomes a great deal of satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you think about a great coach, as I said, is committed to someone getting an A, but also they're brave enough not to protect their own comfort zone at the expense of someone else's development.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people think that this culture stuff that you and I talk about is soft. It's far from soft. This is freaking hard.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, it's this balance between being tough-minded and tender-hearted to say, you know, my role. Now, if you're going to be a coach, which you should be, the first thing you have to define is, what does winning look like?
Yeah.
You know, imagine, you know, many years ago, I was over at that great college, Notre Dame, and I was at a conference there, and I was standing up in the building looking over the big football field. And I thought to myself, what would happen if there were no goalposts on that field? The team would run on the field.
Yeah.
And they would run around and get tired. They would leave the field being totally unsatisfied because they hadn't scored anything. So our first, you know, job as a coach is, where are the goalposts?
Yeah.
Okay. What would happen? You know, you're a golfer. What would happen if they took the greens away?
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, you'd be hitting the ball. Well, I hit it everywhere anyway. You're a good golfer. I'm a bad one. But, you know, that if you weren't going for the green, what would you go for?
Yeah.
So again, the number one responsibility of a great coach is, what does winning look like? Then what do we need together to work with to help you get to that destination? So it's, you know, competency, skills, you know, the purpose of the organization, the values in the organization that are there to protect you and set you free, all of these things that need to be in place. And if you put all those things in place and you exercise on them consistently, you will build an organization that has what I call high will of the people.
Mm.
And if you have high will of the people and a reasonable strategy, you'll have a much better outcome than if you have low will of the people and a reasonable strategy. But most organizations spend a disproportionate amount of their time on strategy versus building the will of the people.
Yes. And I love that. You talked about the formula. I won't butcher it, but I was listening to you on Simon Sinek's show, and you were talking about if you have a 70% formula and then you don't for the strategy, but then you don't bring the people on board. Maybe you could expand on that.
Yeah, the formula is will of the people times strategy equals outcome. So let's write a good strategic plan. We write a strategic plan. We take it to some smart professor. They say 70 out of 100 for your strategic plan. Well, that's pretty good. Most strategic plans are probably wrong and roughly right anyhow. But if only 30% of your people go today and are passionately executing against the elements of the plan to achieve the outcome, you're going to get a 30% outcome. But if 80 or 90% of your people go to work every day, and because they're at a place where they belong, they matter, it's learning, not fear, and they're coached, 80% of that is a much bigger outcome. And I was having a conversation with the CEO a few weeks ago about this, and I said, you know, do you realize that 30% of your people go to work every day and are engaged and 70% are not? And then he kind of blew me off on it. I said, well, I'll give you a challenge. I want you to close the company completely next week for a week. What will you achieve at the end of the week? And he said, nothing. I said, so how come you're allowing 70% of the company to be closed every day?
Yeah.
And the guy went, oh. Now we get into the hard stuff, because, you know, building culture, as my friend Charlie Maloof, who owns a chain of Ashley Furniture stores in Carolina, says, culture is not a microwavable event. It takes a crockpot approach.
I like that.
So, you know, you can't sprinkle fairy dust on an organization and change the culture. You've got to get the four pillars in place, and then you've got to work on them every day, every day, every day. And it's not easy. That's why we have such terrible numbers out there right now. You know, the latest global workforce surveys shows now, even more than ever, with all of the uncertainty around AI and the fear and whatever, that engagement's continuing to drop down. And at the time when, in uncertainty, leaders are trying to push their people harder. So the two things are doing this.
There was Molly Sands over at Atlassian, and I also follow Rebecca Hines, who's been talking to a little bit of this as well. Molly was writing about the fragmentation tax. And I'm seeing that as people, going back to your point, what does winning look like and what do we need to win together? If you just say, let's embrace AI, go and throw a whole bunch of tools in with a bunch of people, people get enamored with the thing that they can build with AI and they run off on this journey. And then someone else finds their thing that they get enamored with and they run off. And the next thing you know, the team doesn't even have a shared sense of what does winning look like. And in fact, not only do they not know what does winning look like, now they feel further apart than ever before. They don't know how they matter to each other. There's no sense of belonging. So it's almost like eroding all four of your pillars.
Yeah. Well, I think the other thing that we're going to have to get used to is, as a leader of the future, how do you, in a situation, manage agents and lead people?
Yeah.
And my theory that I'm starting to develop in my mind, and a dear friend of mine is Rebecca Homkus. I don't know if you know Rebecca. She wrote a book, Thrive, Reset, and what is it? And here, it's a great
book. I'll
Google
it.
Yeah.
Survive, Reset, Thrive. Leading Breakthrough.
Yes.
Yeah.
Rebecca's brilliant. She was a professor at London Business School, a great economist, and we used her at WD-40 and then at Gorilla Glue. And now she's working with a national university where I'm on the board of trustees around culture. And we were talking about this new paradigm around, working, managing agents. So what we need to do is focus more on how do people become coaches to their people, because it'll force them to want to manage their people more, because that's what you do with AI agents. You manage them.
Correct.
But you coach people. So
no, but I think that's a really important one to pause on there, Gary, because we are seeing agents popping up everywhere. And I introduced you recently to my friend Jonathan Raymond over at Wren, and he's been helping us as an advisor on that project. And we're seeing AI create, in my opinion, opportunities for people to realize how they can be in better conversation and relationship with each other. So it's not saying to the AI, hey, help tell Dane and Gary how to work better. It's saying, hey, Dane, I noticed recently that a lot of your messages to Gary have been very short and direct. And that's actually not being in relationship with Gary at work. Like, it might be what he needs, but actually you're not recognizing him. You're not asking what he's working on. Like, let's not let that slip past us.
Correct. And I think there's a distinction there that we've got to really recognize and be prepared to lead through.
Yeah.
You know, I've shared with you a little earlier that I have this model that I created years ago. And, you know, it has what I call what feeds outcomes. And if you think about it, there's three things that there's fact, fiction, and opinion. So those three things feed our beliefs, feelings, and intentions. And that influences the outcome. So I think even more today, as where our beliefs are forming, as our feelings are forming, as our intentions are forming, asking ourselves, is the source of this a fact? Is it fiction or is it opinion?
Yeah.
So, and I think I may have said to you before, one of the things that I got really used to that I still do is I ask myself a question, why do I believe that?
Oh, I love that question.
And, you know, why do I believe what I believe? Because, you know, I love the quote from Brené Brown, which is, you know, in the absence of facts and data, people make up stories and those stories become their truth. And today, even more, we need to make sure that our stories are not creating truths that are not accurate.
Yeah, it's interesting. Dr. Ian McDonald, he used to do a lot of work with my old man back in the CRA Rio Tinto days in the mining industry. They called those mythologies what Brené calls made-up stories. And they said the thing about mythologies in an organization is that they're believed in full. People perceive them as reality. So one day, one of the general managers is driving to work and he sees one of the senior supervisors sitting there fishing. And he's like, hey, you know, Barry, aren't you meant to be at work today? And he goes, it's okay, boss. I'm having a sickie. The fishing's really good. And I've already called ahead and told them I won't be there. And and the mythology in the plant was, you can take your sickies whenever you want if the fishing's good or whatever else it might be. But actually what that meant for the team back in the workplace, it's like, oh, Barry's let us down today. We had this big shift planned. And he's just called it in the morning. And now how do we feel? Because, you know, he was just telling us yesterday how we're going to get this equipment set up for the next shift today.
Sure.
And so the beliefs and the stories that people tell in organizations then can have a distortion effect on actually some of those fundamental pillars that you talk to.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, there was a great book written years ago called Who Moved My Cheese? I'm sure you know it. There was a follow-on on that book called Out of the Maze.
Oh, I haven't read it.
And it, Out of the Maze, it has I actually have this on my little, I just ripped it off the wall. I have it here. And it's all about, it says, the way out of the maze, notice your beliefs. A belief is a thought that you trust is true. Don't believe everything you think. Sometimes facts are just the way you see things. Let go of what isn't working. You can't launch a new quest on old baggage. look outside the maze, consider the unlikely, and explore the impossible. Choose a new belief. Changing what you think doesn't change who you are, and there are no limits to what you can believe, you can do, experience, and enjoy a lot more than you think you can.
Wow.
And that was, I took it out of the book, and I have it, posted on my, with a lot of other stuff, because I'm very bad at remembering things. So
that's brilliant. I mean, we'll have to get Alicia to put that in the show notes. And So in going back to the top of the conversation, in a time when uncertainty is the norm, some of those statements are so hopeful because they allow us to, going back to your question there, why do I believe that? We get to challenge, we get to explore. And if you just think about the math again, the will of the people, if only 30% of people are engaged, imagine if 60% are exploring beliefs and seeing what customers are experiencing and actually telling someone who can do something about it. Like, that's a big lift in business without an ounce of AI.
Absolutely. And we can do this. It's not easy, but we can do it, but it's so rewarding. I mean, so many organizations, we're spending billions of dollars on AI right now in a minuscule amount on developing people. I was talking to someone the other day, and I was putting together a workshop that I, that my ex-colleague Stan Seawich and I do workshops on leadership behavior and, leadership point of view and whatever. And, this whole workshop's going to cost a few thousand dollars. I said, you spend more than that on a dinner for your board meeting.
Yeah.
Help me understand why this is not a great investment in your people.
It's a good question. We've heard a lot of challenge about leakage. You send people off on a course, they come back to work. 6 weeks later, a lot of those things they learned don't happen. How are you seeing learning, and particularly with your mindset on coaching, not managing, how are you seeing learning sort of permeate more broadly and deeper into organizations with that coaching mindset intact?
The leadership has to adopt it as being a key principle. One of our values at WD-40 was, we're going to make it better than it is today, which was all around how do we continue to, what have you done to make it better than it is? I absolutely agree with you. Let's go to, you can't sprinkle fairy dust on an organization and change the culture. And doesn't change with sending anybody to a one-day, course on how do you be a better person. But what do you do when that person goes to that training to have it start to be embedded in the organization? It has to be a commitment that you're going to do that.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it doesn't happen. And that's where a lot of, development dollars are wasted. Oh, we'll just have two sessions on this and the whole world's going to change. Not going to happen.
Yeah. Or we'll turn the tool on. We'll turn that new AI thing on. And now we're going to be really good.
Yeah, of course. No, not going to work.
It's fascinating. I think that went wrong in, the last 10, 15 years on feedback. Everyone was like, well, we need to give more continuous feedback. And they created apps that would allow you to, give someone praise more regularly. But it wasn't really challenging people with care. It wasn't really asking them, what they may be able to believe differently or explore differently. It was just, hey, thanks for putting in a hard shift on that spreadsheet today, Bob, which doesn't really go anywhere.
We mandated that, in the first book that I wrote with Ken Blanchard, Helping People Win at Work, with the byline is, I'm not here to mark your paper, I'm here to help you get an A. And we mandated that at least at a minimum every 90 days, you're going to sit down with the person, people you have the privilege to lead, and you're going to have a conversation kind of like this. Dane, this is what we agreed we were going to do together. This is where we think we are. What's getting in your way? How can I help you? Where do you think we need to pivot? What do we need to think about more? And again, I mean you no harm. I want you to be successful. There's nothing more rewarding to me than seeing people that I had the privilege to lead grow into things that they'd come to me and say, I never thought I could get here. And I'd say, I had faith in you.
Yeah.
You just needed the opportunity to play your best game. So we gave you the opportunity to play your best game. And guess what? You went to the podium. Yay!
It's huge. And yet why is it, do you think, leaders find that such a shift? You know, let's say you've got a decent sized organization, 500, 1,000, 2,000 employees. What is that tipping point that allows a leader to say, this is how we're going to shift our business model? Because it does seem to be more revolution than evolution. You can't kind of do it in this very dust sprinkle, as you say.
Right. They come to the realization that it's not about them. It's about how they allow the people have the privilege to lead to play their best game and getting to that realization. Now, I was fortunate because I'm a dumbass, right? So I got to that realization real quick. But again, I think ego comes into play, short-term thinking comes into play. You know, particularly if you're a public company, they're pressured by what are you going to do for me in the next 90 days? Although they say, but we're here to support you for the long term. I remember when I was, in my role, I'd sit across the desk from some, investment managers that we're long-term investors. I said, what does that mean? Oh, at least 3 to 5 years. I say, well, guess what? I've been here for 15. That's long term.
Yeah.
But I understand why that happens. That's the capital market. So, as a public company, you've got to be, and leaders in public companies, you've got to be really deliberate about who you choose as your shareholder base. Yeah. I've had many conversations with investors where I've said, please don't buy our stock. Because you will never be satisfied because, we do not have the ability to build an enduring company by focusing on 90-day intervals. We'll build an enduring company over time. And that's why I so enjoy my work now with private companies that I'm working with because, they have the opportunity to think about things long-term. As you probably know, I'm on the board of Gorilla Glue That's a private company owned by five brothers. And they are absolutely, no doubt, they are focused on we need to be successful and we need to, grow. But overriding that is we are here for the long term.
Yes.
We are building an endurance. We know there's going to be ups and downs. We want to make sure we've got the best people giving us the best advice. We want to make sure that the organization is efficient. More importantly, that our products serve our end users and consumers in an amazing way. But they say we're never selling this company. This is us for the long term.
No, I love that. And enduring is a really important word. If you do have a private business, whether it's private equity backed or it's family owned, and there's a leader out there listening today, and he's like, and I really need to do more than sprinkle the fairy dust. I've got to drive a shift. How does that leader go and start the conversation with their board? Have you got any views on that, Gary?
That's a really nice question. I think you have to understand the motivation of the owners of the business. For example, the motivation of a private equity firm is they either hold the thing really a short period of time or a longer period of time.
Yeah.
Now, if their goal is to, have a capital event within a short period of time, I think the argument to them is to get the best capital event you can, you need to have an organization that's built to be enduring.
Yes.
Now, whether you want to endure with it or not is a different thing.
Yes.
But I think it's still built to be enduring, which is so important. So I think having that conversation and simply asking, how important is culture and the will of the people in the organization? Do you think it's important at all?
Yeah.
And if so, what are we going to do to at least invest some of our time, talent, and treasure in building that will of the people? Is it going to become a priority to us? And think of all the benefits, retention is high, performance goes up, people love to tell people that they work at the company. So you attract a better group of employees.
Yeah.
But here's the other thing, Dan, and I'm really big about this and I say it often. Imagine a place where you go to work every day, you make a contribution to something bigger than yourself, you learn something new. You're protected and you're set free by a compelling set of values, and you go home happy. Here's the magic. Happy people build happy families. Happy families build happy communities, and happy communities build a happy world. And nobody will argue with you and I today that a little happier world would not be a bad thing.
100%.
So business has a responsibility to add to that. And I've seen firsthand how toxic cultures can destroy individuals and families.
Yeah.
So let's get that clear, that we're here to make the world a better place. And there's nothing bad about profit, nothing bad about it at all. It fuels the engines to grow. But you can be more profitable if you've got an organization where you're sending people home happy. And also, imagine sitting at a dinner table where Dane comes home of a night and bitches and whinges about how he hates his job to his kids. What do those kids say? Oh, I'm never going to do that.
Yeah. I think we've seen a little bit of that with some of the new generation coming in. They're far more discerning about, I love your time, talent, and treasure. They're far more discerning around who they're going to go and work for and who's going to get their discretionary effort now.
Yeah, exactly. Well, time, talent, treasure, and technology, I used to say, are all not abundant. Well, now technology is overly abundant. So, you know, we have to decide how we're going to make sure it benefits the organization.
Yeah, that's it. Let's flip it now. So we talked about a CEO that goes to their board. If there's a CEO or a leader out there, like the market's a tough place right now. There's a lot of people that aren't very excited about having to go out and look for the next job. But if they're sitting there in an organization that isn't investing in the will of the people, is there something that they can do within the business to just start small, or is it very much? Yeah.
Yeah. Do it in the circle that you operate in.
Yeah.
You know, I talked a little bit, shared with you about my theory of pods and mobs.
Yeah. Let's go into that.
So, you know, if a pod can be positive or negative, and from that you can develop in the organization a positive or negative mob, right? So if you have a pod that you work within, how do you create that pod that's really positive? Because you, with the people you lead in the organization, are using those four pillars and the things that you know well to create this environment. People are looking, I want to go and work in Dane's area because, you know, those people are actually smiling and they seem like they're enjoying their work. And did you see the results they got?
Yeah.
Versus I'm going to go and work in, you know, in the pod of this fellow, right? Alec, the soul-sucking leader whose pod is negative and disruptive and not getting good results. And then the mob starts to form from the pod. So a pod is small, the mob gets bigger.
Yeah.
And I've seen that happen in organizations. But the other thing that I would say too, and I love this, Marshall Goldsmith says this, you're not a tree, move.
Yeah. I think that's the big one. I think while people are afraid of moving, one of the big things that leaders can be doing now, there's so much more public information available about how companies lead, how cultures are set. You can start talking to leaders that you might want to go and work with a long time before you're ready to move. And I think I call that outside influence. I think that's really important because if you're constantly farming that community of peers, or potentially even competitors for where is the relationship that's going to inspire me, it may lead to another job. It may lead to an approach that you can bring to your own company to build a pod.
Absolutely.
And it gives you confidence and belief, which sadly, going back to those lonely, isolated, exhausted managers, some of them aren't leaning into the way out of the maze. They're not kind of litigating their beliefs or exploring what's possible.
True. Absolutely true. Yeah. You know, we need to be open to the learning wherever it comes from and open to what's going on wherever it comes from. So I agree.
The other big thing, Gary, that I'm finding fascinating right now, when I look at companies is how they engage with their customers or their supply chain. And I know, you know, with the way that you made your your values hierarchical, you created that protection and clarity for your teams on how they made those decisions. But the world is becoming quite dispersed. And then at the same time with tariffs and some of the things we've seen in the last year or two, there's been big shifts. So how much do you see leaders needing to be more cognizant now than before about who they choose to team with outside of the organizational boundaries?
Yeah, I think it's always been important. I learned my lesson on that, and it cost a few million dollars where we made a decision at many years ago to go a certain direction, and we made it purely based on an economic decision. And we had in place a values reference that we wanted our team to go through. And when we made the decision, I actually said to the person, did this work, did they fit within the values? And yeah, but you know what? They didn't.
No.
And it cost us a few million bucks. And that was the big learning moment there. I'm glad we had it, because we went back and we reinforced the process that we would use in actual selection process of you're taking the prospect partner through our values. And if they didn't align with our values, we knew that eventually we were going to have some sort of disruption.
Yeah.
So, you know, I learned that from Ken Blanchard, you know, my mentor, and, you know, I just love the man to death. And he, you know, he said, values are important, but making sure they're forced ranked or hierarchical is even more important, because, you know, our first one was doing the right thing. Our last one was we value sustaining the economy of the company. And so it meant that we always made decisions about doing the right thing first, even if we forgave a little bit of profitability, because in the long run, it paid out. And the great thing about a forced ranked or a hierarchical set of values, and the reason we put it in place, is when I was given the privilege and opportunity to lead the company, the mission was to take the blue and yellow can with a little red top to the world. It was a strong brand in the US and a couple of other countries, but we knew that the opportunity to grow was really outside of the US. And my concern was, having had the experience of running a division from Australia, that time zone, that link to have to go back and quack up the hierarchy was very disabling.
Yeah.
So I said, when I was given the opportunity, I said, we need to put something in place that allows people anywhere in the world, any time of the day, whenever the sun was rising or sets, to make a decision without quacking up the hierarchy. And it was Ken's advice on the values that did it. So I used to say, anybody in this company can make any decision they need to make anytime, anywhere in the world. I don't care. As long as they put it through the values as they made the decision. And if we made decisions that didn't work out, my first question would be, help me understand how you saw this through. And if they went through the values and it still didn't work, I said, that's great. You know, you gave it your best effort. That's really good. But it saved us and enabled us, more importantly, because people, as I said, these values were to protect people and set them free.
Yes. I love protect and set free. On that, it brings up a question. You're an extremely progressive leader. I've been studying, reading about leaders for years, and what you've bought, there are a few others in that cohort, but what you've bought that is so clear for people is very special. Diving into something that I'm now experiencing as I continue my journey is feelings. So we've talked a lot about values, we've talked a lot about behaviors, we talked about sending people home happy. But the reason I want to dive into feelings, Gary, is that I know growing up in Australia as a young lad, we didn't talk a lot about our feelings. You know, we weren't encouraged to say, you know, what we wanted or why we wanted it and those types of things. And it's a big part of my learning as a parent now, as well as a leader. And as I think about feelings, I was talking to Rebecca Johnson, who came on the show just recently, and she had values at the top, like you do, then behaviors, But then she finished the one page with felt experiences. And I was just like, oh, that's really interesting, because I know I feel something before I know why it's a problem. And I'm like, I wonder if there is a way, or if you've seen it in your own experiences, of encouraging people to sit with their feelings a little bit more, particularly in this time of uncertainty, and, you know, how you see that as a role that we can be playing as leaders and in teams.
Absolutely. You know, I think, as you said, when we grew up in Australia, but I don't know whether it was just Australia. I think it was a time of life. I think today we are more attuned to how do we feel than we ever were before, for whatever reasons, I'm unsure. But I think the other thing that's important is feelings are generated and they can be reminded by memories. And, you know, we used to say, and I say, you know, memories are the most wonderful things we can have. And for example, and you've met my son, Pete, and, you know, he's an Aussie as well, but he lives here in the US. And Pete and I went to the Australia-USA World Cup match up in Seattle. We flew up on a Thursday. We went to the match on the Friday. And we created this amazing set of memories, he and I together. And every time I think about that, my feelings come back. So my question is, what are the memories, or what are the events, what are the things we're creating in our organizations that are memory locks that remind us of how we feel about things?
Oh, I love that.
So I think that's really important. And I've shared this with you too before, is, you know, I also need to be reminded of what I do. I have on my little notebook over here that I kind of carry around, you know, I have a little plaque on here.
Yeah.
And it says, am I being the person I want to be right now? And then it says, who is that person? And the little list here says, I want to be grateful, caring, empathetic, reasonable. I want to be a listener. I want to be fact-based. I want to have a balanced opinion. I want to be curious. I want to be a learner. And I want to throw sunshine, not a shadow. And the reason I have to continue to remind myself of that, and I have it on here, I have it on my computer, is we can create feelings in people if we take our leftovers to them. And we have no right to take our leftovers to people.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Leftovers is a great way to frame it too, because I've seen it. I've seen it even as I come home at the end of a tough day at work and one of the kids gets it, or I turn up on a Monday and something hasn't quite gone wrong in the team and I'm feeling stressed about a board meeting that's come up, and they don't get my full presence. They get a snappy response. It's not creating good memories.
It's not. And I used to, you know, I'd said, you know, it's like taking half your plate of leftovers to someone and saying, enjoy this meal with me. So, well, who ate the steak?
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah. Right? So, you know, I used to use, and I've had that little list for many years now, because I'd come out of a meeting just as you would say, and I'd go, wait a minute, I'm going to go meet with Dane now. I have to remind myself of who the person is I want to be.
Yeah.
Because Dane deserves the meat and potatoes.
Yeah.
Not just the potatoes. And I have to do that. So it's okay. Say to myself, all right, I'm good. All right. I'm yours.
I love that. I love the positive framing there, Gary. And it actually reminds me of a conversation I had with a new coach I met recently. And he was saying that once upon a time, he was a climber. Coaching is like being on the belay line and giving someone some support from below as they move up the face. And then he realized that one of his roles as a coach is actually more inclined to be sort of the sculptor who's got the block. And it's just like, your essence is in there and my essence is in here. And we need to work to kind of remove the interference, remove the rough edges, and be true to ourselves. And then the learning and the opportunity comes forward. And I was like, that's a far cooler way to think about removing interference, really being present, choosing to be in that moment with anyone.
And we have to make those choices as leaders.
Yeah.
You know, in the work that I do now in my coaching practice, it's become, I believed this before, but I believe it even more now. And the first part of my coaching practice is awareness. Are you aware as a leader how your behavior impacts others? And they go, yes, of course I am. Okay, let's go ask those that you lead. And I come back and say, this is what you think. This is what they think. They're right.
And they go,
oh yeah, okay. So now the next part is intention. What are we going to do to intentionally change that behavior to create the results we want that's going to deliver the outcome that you want?
Yeah.
And that's the hard part, because changing behavior is not as easy as we think. It becomes reminding and repetition and all of the things that go with it.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Well, this has been a great conversation. I loved the way you opened up on the concept of intelligent patience. I think for all of those leaders and teams that are feeling rushed right now into an uncertain world where they're meant to have the answers, I really love that. The four pillars, again, coming into belonging, mattering, learning is the objective, and then coaching and not managing. All teams can benefit from that tomorrow. And as we got into this whole piece around the high will of the people in your formula, high will of the people times strategy equals outcomes, and the terrible engagement statistics, we've been talking about it for years, but rather than putting the frills, as Lily Zhang, who came on the show, talked about, on the problem, actually inviting people into the work, setting a clear sense of what it means to win together. I thought that's phenomenal. And then as we moved into the conversation of being an enduring company, even if you're on a short turnaround with a private equity backer, like it drives value, not just for your shareholders, but for your people and anyone who's looking at your company, customer, vendor, shareholder, future buyer, future employee, can see that enduring value if they spend just enough time to see how people experience it. And then lastly, I do really think that the feelings and creating these memories that lock in some of this positive work is important right now. I think the new generation is really looking for it. And I particularly like your framing of the pods and the mobs, because you don't have to do it all at once. You find those little pods, find those pockets of magic in your teams, invest time and energy, give them the next project, and let them explore what's possible. There's just so much hope that comes with Gary.
Yeah. And you'll feel better as a leader. You would have made a difference in the world.
Yeah. That's the best part.
That's the best part, man. That's it.
Well, this has been a blast. So thank you again for taking the time with me and to share your wisdom and stories. And
thank you, Dane. Thank you for what you do. I mean, you're doing the hard work here in amplifying what we need to do to make the world a better place. And congratulations on the 200th episode. What a wonderful contribution you've made to leadership. So good on you, mate.
Thanks, Gary. I really appreciate it.
Just a quick note before we go. The views and opinions shared in this episode are those of our guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the host, Dane Gruneveld, the leader group, our patron Huddle 3, or our partners and affiliates. Any scenarios discussed are for the purpose of fueling creative thinking and conversation and should be viewed only in this context. Dane, leader, our sponsors, partners, and affiliates do not endorse any guest or any organization they may be associated with. It's important to remember that every workplace is as individual as the people within it. Our recommendation is to always seek solutions that are specifically designed to help serve your team's unique needs. And to this point, please know we're here, ready to help you find the best way forward, no matter where your starting point is. You can connect with Dane or myself, Alicia McCraw, on LinkedIn or via the links contained in the show notes. Thanks again for tuning in. And hey, if you think someone in your network would benefit from this episode, feel free to share it or give us a 5-star rating. Those 5 little stars really help us reach more curious people like you. We'll catch you next time on the Future of Teamwork.